consider myself a woodworker, though people say you're more than a woodworker, you're an artist, you're a designer, doll, and I just laugh about it and say you can call me anything you want, but I do make my living at my craft. And if I were not able to sell my things, I'd have to do something else. I couldn't afford to do them, do my pieces for pleasure. I really couldn't.
Not that the man who's speaking has much to worry about. Sam Maloof is an internationally known woodworker. He's been the subject of two films, currently has pieces of his furniture on display in a number of museums and in the Vice President's mansion, and he's conducted workshops in strange parts of the world, most recently in Fairbanks, where he's been instructing a woodworking workshop at the Native Arts Center at the University of Alaska.
I don't put myself into a position where I'm doing things that I don't like to do. In other words, even now, in all the years that I've worked, I've been able to make pieces that I myself enjoy doing and that I could live with, and I've been very fortunate.
Maloof hasn't always been a woodworker. He started in business for himself 32 years ago after a career in another art field as a graphic artist. Since making that change, he's hardly been in the starving artist category.
I do about $100,000 a year just by myself.
Maloof specializes in one-of-a-kind furniture, not production work.
For example, if you were to come and order 8 chairs from me in a dining table, I'd make 8 chairs on a dining table. I wouldn't say, well, somebody may want 8 like this, so I'll make 16. But everything is made to order for that particular person.
What is it about making furniture that particularly attracts you?
Working with wood. Working with wood. It's very warm. You're working in 3 dimension rather than 2 dimension, which I'd worked in before. It's a very personal thing, I think. And you get involved. People have asked me, well, do you work in plastics? Do you work in this or that? And my answer is, once you've worked in wood, I just don't know how you could take a tangent and work in another material.
Although you have this feeling for wood, are there certain kinds of wood that you prefer to work in than others?
I work mostly in walnut. I would say 90% of my pieces are walnut. And then the other 10% are teak, and I use brown oak, which is a very handsome wood, English brown oak. And I use rosewood, but of course now it's very hard to get hold of. But I like the walnut the best.
Why?
It has a warmth to it that the others don't have. It's a very sensuous wood, I think. And you can kind of, you can feel when you're working with it how it relates to what you're doing with it.
Although Maloof claims it's working with wood that attracts him to furniture, there's more than just the attraction of the material.
My furniture is quite sculptural. And when I first started, people would always comment about, this is sculpture rather than furniture. And it still is, pretty much. So I am working in wood much as a sculptor would work. But now I see work that young people are doing, and my things look pretty straight. I've always maintained that if a chair didn't sit well, it would be a very beautiful chair and beautifully made, but if it didn't sit well, then it's not a very good chair.
Evidently, California-based woodworker Sam Maloof makes very good chairs, including the rocking chair recently ordered for the Vice President's house. That one may not sit well, but it probably rocks up a storm.
Old rocking chair got me, came by my side.
Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Sunday night, the last of 7 nights of the stick dance celebration, is the cleanup or mask dance. Romeo Wally Stickman explains.
That's when they put a string across the hall and they have canvas over it, and every the first people that come in is the woman. The woman's come in with little dish full of anything that they can make, like cookies, pie, cake, piece of fish that's cut up, piece of frozen fish, anything that you can eat, you know, little bite at a time, you know. And all the women do that, and then some of them dress in, they have a face mask, and they dress up funny, you know, and there's all the people strung across in front of the canvas that are singing, you know. A couple of them would have drums, you know. And there's a couple guys on each side of the string that would be sitting down and using a long stick like this, a long little stick, you know. And they have little white rabbit tail tied to that string, I mean stick, you know. So they just like keeping time with the guys that are singing.
The singing and drumming differs considerably from the sounds and the movements of the previous nights. For one thing, there is a drum accompaniment, though the morning songs are sung a cappella. The movements are those of Eskimo dancing, not the scarf in hand rocking motion called washtub dancing of the other evenings. In the past, there was an active trade route between Nulato and the Eskimo village of Unalakleet, and people from Unalakleet traveled to Nulato for the stick dance. When the women come in and stand before the low canvas curtain, they do the traditional women's style Eskimo dance, waving their arms and bending at the knees. After all of the women have put food over the canvas and danced, it's the men's turn.
All the men go out the same thing. And they go in a store and they buy whatever they can buy, you know, coke, candies, and apples, oranges, whatever they can come in with, you know. And then they does the same thing. And there would be about maybe five or six, seven, or eight more people that would be, boys, that would be dressed in funny clothes too, you know. Just like a Halloween night, you know, the same thing. They use masks and stuff like that. And then they do the same thing, they dance, you know.
The men's dancing is the bold, arms-up, bend-at-the-knees, foot-stomping Inupiaq Eskimo style, while a row of women sing and beat the drum or blazo can to keep time, and two other women sit on either side of the canvas, white rabbit fur-tufted wands swaying back and forth to the music. After everyone has danced, including people in costumes who may go in and out of the hall several times as people try to guess their identity, it's time for making speeches, the last speeches of the last night of the stick dance celebration.
Lecture! Shut up!
Martha Jo is 85 years old. At this year's stick dance, she dressed four people, two for a nephew, one for a son, and another for her late husband, Frank. She is a small woman with thick glasses and a cane. She always wears a dress, even in the coldest weather, and the night of the stick dance, her garments were covered with a fine, long fur parka. She does not expect to live much longer now, nor to see another stick dance.
And I sing this since just like I wake up, 1905. That's many years ago. We used to dance all kinds of dance, but nobody is doing it now. I said all the young generation that don't know about it. So I think this is the last time I see this fun. I'll be happy if I go there. That's what I think.
Tassie Ann Saunders was the next to speak. A striking, powerful woman with white hair, she had been leading the singing. 2 years ago, she dressed for her late husband, Kentucky. Her speech addressed the problems that split the stick dance into two camps, one for holding it in the new community hall and the other group, who insisted on using the old hall where the stick dance was ultimately held.
I'd like to thank you very much. This old hall didn't cave in, or the new hall didn't cave in. So the both of this time just like one. So we should, anyway, I'm going to tell you this in Indian too. Goshi, but you thought I'm your 20 year old child, yes? No, change your nickel, good, good nickel, not all cheese talk.
Her speech apparently was about the way people used oratory long ago, how important it was. She was not speaking in conversational Koyukon, but in a type of Koyukon spoken in times past, a type that is referred to as using high words, and neither of the elderly women on either side of me could translate just what Tassie Ann Saunders was saying, but the effect was dramatic.
Thank you very much.
With the speeches, the week of stick dance was nearly over. The food that the men and women had brought in to place over the canvas was distributed to everyone, especially children, who thoroughly enjoyed the singing and dancing, especially when people entered the hall dressed in snow machine suits, large rubber boots, overstuffed swimming trunks, crash helmets, thick scarves, face paint, and other disguises of the masked dance. And with the distribution of food, the Nulato Feast for the Dead, the resting of the souls of the dead and the repaying of people who had helped with the dead, ended. The 1980 Stick Dance, or HIO, week-long celebration that culminated months, perhaps years of preparation, was over. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. People were dressed on Saturday night in Nulato's Stick Dance, or Feast for the Dead. The week-long celebration, held approximately every 2 years, honored 13 people who had died in years past, including, for the first time, a non-Native person who had died in the community, a Catholic priest who had served in Nulato and is buried in the village cemetery on the hill. Nineteen new morning songs were composed, many of them for two young men and a young woman, all in their early 20s, who had been well-liked and related to almost everyone in town. The songs were sung Monday through Thursday evening, after the potlatch, while women did so-called washtub dancing. A song was composed for the priest being commemorated as well, Father Charles Saufeld, and that was sung at the close of the Sunday morning mass. Church participation was probably the most dramatic feature of this year's stick dance, or HIO. In the past, the Catholic Church had tried to suppress a custom they considered pagan and in conflict with church dogma, and had been successful in their efforts until the early 60s when the stick dance was revived. But this time, the church was definitely part of, rather than apart from, the action. Two people were dressed for Father Saufeld, Romeo Wally Stickman, a village elder active in the church, and another priest, Father James Sebesta, pastor at the neighboring village of Caltag, who received a set of liturgical garments for Mass, including beaded moosehide slippers depicting the host, made by several women in town. The activities were coordinated by a nun, Sister Ann Evelyn, who also participated in the washtub dancing one evening and helped serve at one of the potlatches. Even more unusual was the presence of not only the Father Superior for Alaska, but the bishop as well. Bishop Whalen presided at a special mass held in the new community hall to bless new grave markers. Never before had the Catholic Church been so heavily involved in a local religious celebration, a celebration for the dead that coincided in part with a church festivity commemorating death and life after death, Easter and the resurrection of Christ. The church provided only one of two potential conflict areas, the other centered around the new community hall built some distance in back of the village. The old hall was built in 1952, is log, square, dark, and small, but possesses a cupola in the center of the roof, surrounded by the only windows in the building. The spruce pole or stick used on the night of the actual stick dance, the fifth night of the activities, has traditionally been placed up into the cupola and tied to a supporting beam. But with the advent of a larger, well-lit hall, it was announced that the stick dance would take place in that location, creating less crowded conditions to accommodate residents and the numerous visitors from villages up and down the Yukon River. But there was a problem, some thought. The ceiling was too low. That problem was attended to by removing some boards, revealing a crossmember for tying on the pole, and enough room for the stick to poke through the ceiling. But the night of the stick dance, after the potlatch, the only one held in the new hall, the event occurred in the old hall after all. Several people involved in the dressing this year insisted that the old hall be used. It was traditional to do so, they said, and claimed the floor of the new hall would cave in and the old folks would have a difficult time walking back to the new hall. And even though several dozen elders walked back to the new hall, waiting for the dancing and the subsequent bringing in of the stick, word came back that the old hall would be used. Those few people who had insisted on using the former location had won, and everyone shifted downtown. For a while, there was a rumor that there would be two stick dances, one in each hall, but that didn't materialize, and the community factions combined almost accidentally. There were hard feelings about the power of a few people to sway the turn of events, the inevitable surfacing of the factionalism present in small towns everywhere. But the tradition of the stick dance persisted over the squabbling to result in a stick dance celebration many villagers thought was among the best ever. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.